here in Cork, and thank you, Paul, for inviting me. And also, I've never experienced a poetry challenge before, and that was very interesting, and very unique, very strong poems coming from the floor. I'm going to start with a poem of childhood. Children have this great capacity to sort of bring us down a level, you know, when we're getting a little bit too full of ourselves. And this is a poem that I dedicated to my niece, Shannon. It's called My Niece Takes Me on a Journey. Look, she says, and offers the drawing. Who is it? It's you, silly. And of course she's right. It is me. There I am with one leg longer than the other, going for that big step forward, my purple eyes lopsided with the effort, a manic yellow grin, and my arms wide as a tightrope walker's. And this? She looks at me and shakes her head. My car? I recognize it now, its green box balanced on two wheels, hovering under my left armpit. It's light on, it's journey waiting. And I followed up with another form of childhood, and this one is in my own childhood, myself and my sister Mary. It's called Arrow. It was one of those hot summers, 65 probably. I made arrows from reeds that grew from the back of our terrace gardens. I'd been shown by a boy at school how to squeeze a 1-inch nail into the soft head of the reed, just above one of those knuckles in its thin, unbending finger. How to wedge it in and find it. I was spending the afternoon sending my arrows from a bow into the open mouth of a target I had chalked on the back of the coal house door. I was good. My score was high, and my technique, which I was imagining as if I were an onlooker, part of the crowd gasping as Robin Hood uncloaked himself with his mastery at that famous tournament long ago, was excellent. Each arrow thumped itself solidly into the door's timber and trembled. It was then that my sister came out. With her round face, her dolls, all of her girl stuff. She stood in the shadow of my skill. I tell, she said. We both knew I'd been told to stop, to leave that door alone, that arrows were dangerous. I'll tell, and we both knew that she would. I turned. I notched an arrow. Bent the bow. You'd better not. I was in the green forest, my band of men watching. My sister was on the sheriff's side. You'd better not. The air held its breath for a soft moment. Birds were quiet. She turned to run, Mammy, towards the house. The arrow flashed from the bow, making its own tunnel through the air. It sank into her chest. I saw a trout speared from a river, its cry a sliver of light. And as she ran, the shaft danced up and down until it lost its grip, fell and was kicked away by her running feet. And still, it's not the doom that came upon me, but the way the arrow danced that lives. Tapping between bones, you know, I'm going to be here all night and you're going to get fed up with me. This next poem is one that I wrote for my brother. My brother's in the Irish Army, and he had a spell in Lebanon, and he came home and he told me this story, and like all poetry steals, and I stole this poem from my brother. It's called A Walk in the Field. A few things I have to just explain about it. When you step on a mine, you can hear it sort of ticking, but they're fairly clever, some of these mines, and they don't just blow up. They're expecting a tank to come over. So if you add more weight on top of it, it will not explode until the weight gets to a certain level. And the other thing is that if you're close to an explosion and you see the air sort of hitting the back of your, hitting your body, means you're outside of the main epicenter of the explosion, as you say. If you don't feel that, you need to check your limbs. Very cheerful. A walk in a field. I remember you telling it home from the lab, wife in the other room, how your friend stepped on a mine, how he froze, knowing not to move, his scarecrow shadow stretching, while you followed your footprints back to gather rocks, pile them round his feet, adding pressure, back and forth, each placed gently like gifts for a king, until the second click gave warning, seconds to move, sprinting, shouting, diving as the ground ripped open, the world folding over you, raining. And this next one is called The Ferryman. And it's an incident that happened in the UK. Ferryman. The ferry line swung in a long arc over the river. It was old, basic. The boat attached by a loop that the ferryman slipped along the line, pulled down on, hauling us across to sit in the sun with our pints. Then, in that way that a crowd lifts its head, we looked up, saw a young man out on the line, crawling leg over leg for a bet, crossing back to the pier. Halfway over, his arms hung straight. We were sure he was gone, but he stayed hand grab to hand grab on the long pull up to the centre, to the other side. Both banks broke into cheers, and the ferryman jerked his boat into movement, crossing over the water after him. This is how it should be, surprising yourself, being able to stand on the far shore with your arms crossed, resting, taking the applause, waiting for the ferryman. My next poem is called The Royal Academy. And in the UK, so the competition happens each year. The Royal Academy is an art gallery in London, a very famous one. And each year they have a sort of an open period where you can anonymously send your paintings or your sculptures to the Royal Academy to be judged. And anyone who is judged good enough to be in the Royal Academy on that judging would be, they'll find themselves hung on the walls, or they'll find the sculpture on the plinth, and people can go and see. That's how quite often an unknown painter or sculptor makes his name, if he has a showing in the Royal Academy. And I was talking to people about this, and it was about the same time as I was trying endlessly to get poems into Poetry Review, the sort of the top level poetry magazine in the UK. And I was thinking about it, so I wrote this poem. The poem is really about trying to get a poem into Poetry Review. It's called The Royal Academy, and then I thought I'd send it off to Poetry Review. And the great news was that they actually published it. It is the only poem I've ever published in Poetry Review, and it's called The Royal Academy. I'm taking my poem to be judged at the Royal Academy. I'm taking it on the train. It's here on the seat beside me, wrapped in brown paper. Originally, I'd intended something large, but that's been done so well, anything now would be a poor copy. The train lurches through the suburbs, that garden hall stain and grime, washed out ochres, smoky craze. My poem sits quietly. Perspective and composition have given way to ideas. I'm taking the idea of my poem to be judged at the Royal Academy. I've been thinking about it here in the train beside me, touching it up as the train enters into the dream of backyards and walls, windows curtained with newspapers, words catching the sun behind glass, browning. It's always the dream that we want. I'm taking the dream of my home to the Royal Academy as the train leaves the tracks and the houses gather up their lean-tos and sheds, their rusting bikes, and peel away from the carriage window. We're together as the sky rushes down and clouds press their dead flesh pounds against the glass. I'm being taken to the Royal Academy, dressed in brown paper. I'm holding something tight and small, like a word not yet written. I'm holding something for the judges. I'm holding something that will subvert the walls of the Royal Academy. It is not my first time in Cork. I've been here a few times before. I came down here to West Cork, to Amcara, where the writing retreat is. And I was intending to try and write some poems to finish off this collection. And I spent the first day staring at blank paper and doodling, and it just wasn't working out very well. And I decided I would escape, and I would take some time out. And then I did the really dangerous thing of crossing over the border into South Kerry. And there in a coffee shop where I was sort of enjoying myself and reading some poems to myself and somebody else's poems, when the sort of door burst open and these schoolgirls came in, it was a sort of miraculous sort of thing. And I immediately started writing. And I think almost in that shop itself, I wrote the next poem. It's called Seeing the Light. So Terry's actually good for something, but you have to write poems. We don't give a Terry man here. Seeing the Light. How sophisticated these girls are, 13 or 14 years old, sitting in this coffee house, eating pastries, conspiring together with their dark eyes, so that everyone else here feels like outsiders. I swear to God, one says in our South Kerry hit. And whatever it is she attests to, they all bubble into laughter. I broke the surface of the book I was reading to take notice of them, full of themselves, the way most of us are empty of ourselves, throwing their light about this room like they have batteries to spare. Globules of it landing on tables, where old men mutter to newspapers, where a woman checks that she hasn't changed in a small pocket mirror. And one globule touches down on my table, between my poetry book and the salt cellar, sits there, pulsing, excited by its own luminance. It would seem that I'm the only one to notice. The girls have no regard, incandescent as they are in their high voltage. And the only impossibility the old men believe in is their own. And the young woman reflects only on herself. I pick up my gift and place it on my tongue, looking for that particular wisdom of youth that would make everything possible again. This poem is called Ordnance Survey, West Cork. Hungry Hill, Derry Chancy, Coombane. High names in her silent room. His dinner cold on the table. The clock slowly wiping its face. Clavigarath, Knockhorn, Rams Hill. The quiet life. The long pick of the room. And now this unfolding of an old map, the wood grain stain of a mountain range, her finger touching each town. The moon is loud on the road, her right hand cold on the pen, frozen like 5 points of a star when she reached out to his falling. Now he sways at the gate, singing. In her other hand, the mountains are folded away, West Cork, the breath of the Irish Sea between the one hand and the other, the names are packed in our head, Rams Hill, Knockhorn, Cabbagarrett, Coombane, Derry Clancy, Hungry Hill. And there are some love poems of this sort. I have to be very careful with these because my wife is with me. This first one is called The Fields. The field still coils itself round behind the hill where I used to take her, to lie hidden from the road, close as two blades of grass, her body scalding through her dress. Now at twice the age I try to find her, some remnant of light perhaps that holds the gleam of her hair, but I cannot conjure her up, just a vague sense of connection. And I wonder if this isn't all, a boy, a field, and a girl, a road coming and going. And to stay with that theme, this is called Charlie Thatcher. And it's set in my hometown of Dundalk, and some of the street names I mentioned are the street names of Dundalk. Charlie Thatcher. It's the way the roots caught fire in the morning sun, or the way the fields along the Castletown Road flooded into green just after dawn. It's what I expected. The coin flipped the land on its tail, the dice tumbled each time to a two, the wishbone holding on to its handle. But when Kevin unzipped your street with his Kawasaki, parted St. Nicholas's Avenue like a comb through his hair, showed you the straight line out, the roads beyond Ord Esmond, Seatown, Bridger Crin. When he opened the map of the possible that lay beyond the roads I walked, you were gone. I cannot say when, Mary, exactly, but perhaps it was leaning into a corner, the hedgerows streaking the sky, and the sun setting its palms between his shoulder blades, where your cheek may have touched the dark of his leathers. And perhaps then, too, I was seated as usual on a shuddering train, ready to move out of Connolly Street Station, coming home for the weekend, my university boots in my bag, expecting everything the same. No more than you on the platform to meet me, no less than believing that the world started and stopped at your door. There's a sort of tradition that seems to be happening in poetry readings I've noticed, where the poet comes along and he reads from his book, and then he orders a little loose sort of piece of paper, and he says, this is a poem I've written very recently. So this is my recent poem, and it's dedicated with a lot of respect to the old poets who read before me. It's called Reflex. It might have been a reflex, the way she turned away from me, some half-baked sense of propriety. But I felt her eyes taste mine, the way you might let your mouth taste an apple tart straight from the oven, its sweetness blacking the edges of the plate, or the way you might sail a paper boat into the sunset, your fingers touching those of a lover, that little rasp of flesh on flesh, stuttering the moment. It might have been hatred or loathing that had the power to turn her, but it was this other thing instead. So that the toss of her hair in the door dark frame was the last I saw of her, the last I will always see. And given all those poems, I need to write a poem now that's dedicated to my wife, if encounters or lived beyond sunset. This is called our hair like a river. She ran down Grafton Street to meet me, stopped halfway and pulled up her socks. The wind whipped up her red hair and she smiled. She smiled out at me and laughed at me, for I was home from England. We were getting married that weekend, stepping out into the world together. The wind whipped up her red hair, spreading light across the street, spreading light onto the washed doorstep of that big city shop, where she knelt for a moment on the footpath, her knees leaning in the sun, till she let her skirt fall back down, standing up again to run down Grafton Street to greet me, her hair out behind her like a river, her arms opening up to drown me, the sun forever on her face. And some sort of semi-mythology poems, strange tale. The first one is called The Fisherman's Tale. I stole her from the ocean, her wet breath salty to my lips. I rode her astride, watching her moon eyes fill, her tail thumping and thrashing beneath me. She cried like a gull, her hands beating my back. I took her home, kept the door locked, came back in the evenings with my arms full of fish. She got used to it, slowly losing her sheen, touch of green in her hair. Her tail split in two. Soon you'd never have known she wasn't my wife. Her lovemaking grew intense, her mouth surging over me. She would sigh, toss her head, her hair storming the pillow, body lifting like a wave sometimes. I became content with her. 10 years. Slept easy in her arms, till I woke to an unlatched door, the moon spilling in. I ran barefoot over rock, found her naked in the water, the stars sailing on her back. She called out to me, opening her arms, but I couldn't swim and was afraid. Afraid of the wild joy in her eyes, her 10 years inside. She splashed back into the moon, scattering it, coiling herself in its cool till her body shone green. In a fit she was gone, leaving me to sail my boat, a gull thrown back on the wind. Called The Morning After. The look in her eye helped me recall it as I lay exhausted in the cream sheets of her bed. Rest, she said. The sun was cartwheeling through the windows, slamming off the white walls, the furniture. My back was saddle sore, my knuckles raw red. I remembered the moon bouncing along the tree lines, how the road kicked back behind me as I sped, slicing the air with the bullets of my face, my muscles full of the journey's song, my heart loud as a laugh keeping time to my ears. And before that, tumbling out of bed in the dark, with my fingers clenched, my fists hardening, my toes fusing into hoof, spine stretching back and my neck arching. I remember the walls of the room like a cage, the need to burst through wind, to pound the rose, the earth, and the look in her eye when I stamped and turned, tossing my head against the lazy fill of her lampshade, causing light to dance, wink up the gilt handles of her wardrobe, lick a shine of her long black riding boots, and her voice, husky, easy, easy, my love. some poems down now about my father. The back of this book is Godley's poems. This first one is called One Frozen Winter. There were swans used to come to shuck at the back of our house when I was a boy, and there was one particular winter, two birds that stayed back, I guess maybe one of them had been injured, and the swans tend to stay in pairs. And my mother used to feed them, but coming up to Christmas time, she was a bit neglectful, sort of tied up with the Christmas stuff, and so there was sort of a knock on the door, and there was a swan tapping its beak on the door. Decided it was going to get fed anyway. And it's called One Frozen Winter. One frozen winter, two swans remained in the shock behind our house, out of injury, maybe unable to escape. They learned to depend on my mother for bread dipped in warm milk, leftover vegetables. Daddy showed me how to feed them, crust from my palm and keep my fingers safe. In the hectic run-up to Christmas, my mother forgot. Through the tap of a beak on the door, emitted one bird, then its partner, steering the massive bolts of their bodies between chair and table, sailing into the kitchen, crossing that border between outer and inner, between wild and tame, waiting for us to pay host to them, there in the sanctuary of our own kingdom. Years later, Daddy too crossed into a new kingdom, walking home from Mass in that suit whose knees he warmed to shine, between one footstep and the next, slamming the footpath with the full weight of his body, a knocker hammered down against the door, his head cracked and bruised under the makeup when I saw him laid out later at home, his hands softly folded without a scratch. And he off in some other kitchen, I like to think, sailing in like a swan, or the way snow rises up on the back of the wind and then settles down. Everything. It's a poem, I guess, about loss. It can be any kind of loss. So I guess it's dedicated to anyone who's lost something that's important to everything. Now everything has gone. The moon with its cold music. The slow white of the snow. The small turning of the leaf in the dark. The gate closing in on itself, the dustbin with its fat glass, the buzz of the last van in the distance, you. There are books on the table, all the pages torn, the words have burned through the covers and smolder on the floor. Now everything has gone. The trees with their tattered leaves, the birds with their crooked smiles, the sky that sat at the top of the steps, the coin in the gutter, the bicycle leaning on its shadow, the horizon's accident in the distance, you. See how the water calls, there is such room under the waves. You could go down into it like the sun and never be cold again. Now everything has gone. The wall with its vertical pane. The little hooks in the wind. The rustle of children in the park. The dark. The road's irresistible urge to travel. The creak of the stars as they shift their geometry. The galaxy. You. just two more ones. This one's called My Father's Suitcase. When I was young, my father was unemployed for 3 or 4 years, and eventually he got a job in Dublin. I lived in Dundalk, which was about 52 miles away. And in those days, 52 miles was a long, long way. And he would go and work during the weekend at the home at the weekend. So he sort of became a weekend father, which is something I didn't really understand at the time. And this point sort of comes, the next point is the final point comes out. But this is about me when I was probably about 13, 14 years old, walking my father to the station and carrying his case, called my father's suitcase. And the other thing is my father was never on time for anything in his life. And that's particularly as well. And, you know, the last mass on Sunday changed from 12:30 to 1:30, and he was still late. My father's suitcase. Sunday evenings, invariably late, we walked to the station, me lugging his suitcase, seeing him off, his breath short from the long hill. He would ask me to run, tell the station master to hold the train. Even then I knew that the world ordered itself differently, and never wanted the weight of that task. And the times I stood, my sweat cooling, the train pulling away at my back, case at my feet, watching him chug himself onto the platform, that look of dismay on his face, so that I felt that my effort was less than it should have been. And I wanted to give him the miracle of a train panting, its doors still open. But instead, we would turn, start the slow walk home, the heavy case in his hand. And the final poem is called Man on the Moon. As I said, when my father was off to Dublin and became a weekend father, I sort of thought he might as well be in the moon as be in Dublin. My father went to the moon and left me in our end of terraced house with its chest high garden grass, its clothesline pole that wobbled, and a bedroom full of brothers. He went to the moon and I stood in the garden at night, looked up and wondered if he was looking down, if he dreamt of my sisters and mother, of me and my brothers sleeping in our large back bedroom. Looked up at the pebble-dashed sky, trying to imagine the face of my father, a stout man in a spacesuit, his cardboard suitcase grasped in his gauntleted hand, his oxygen strapped to his back. Looked up and blinked the stars from my eyes, blinked him a message in Morse, that it was time it was over, that he should put the moon behind him, shake its dust from his boots, and arrive by rocket, plane or parachute, stand there beside me and name me the names, the constellations. Thank you.